Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we've got Helen Castor talking about Elizabeth I, a study in insecurity.
It's such a privilege to be here to talk about... Do I click on? Elizabeth, here she is. The woman who started my obsession with history more years ago than I'm currently prepared to admit. The book I've written about her is short. It's part of a series, The Penguin Monarchs, that gives every monarch from Athelstan to our own dear queen an allocation of just 25,000 words, which is really not very much at all. So it wasn't an easy task. And it may seem strange looking at what is only the beginning of a series of extraordinary and majestic portraits painted of Elizabeth over a 45-year reign, that when I was trying to find a way to talk about her life in this very short book, the theme that occurred to me was insecurity. Now, I hope it's clear that I don't mean insecurity in the sense of any lack of what we would now call self-esteem. Elizabeth was extraordinarily able and extraordinarily self-possessed. But I did want to write a psychological study of this remarkable woman, because I began to realize that Elizabeth's life was marked by a more profound and persistent lack of security in terms of her exposure to both psychological trauma and actual practical danger than anyone else I've ever studied. Now, that might sound slightly odd, given that my previous book was about Joan of Arc, and Joan of Arc's short life didn't turn out so very well. But Joan of Arc did not expect to die in the horrible way she did. In fact, right up to almost the very end, she was absolutely convinced that God would save her. So what I'm talking about with Elizabeth is something different, a pervasive consciousness of threat, a life lived in the constant knowledge that very little could be relied on. And famous though Elizabeth is, I don't think we usually recognize that. And I don't think we usually recognize it precisely because she is so famous. Stories we know well, like those of the Tudors, can easily slip in our minds into something a little bit more like a fairy tale. We skip lightly through the familiar details and we don't always think about their human reality. And at the same time, we also know how well this particular story turned out. Not just with a coronation, but with this. Gloriana in all her glory. And because we know exactly what's coming, it's easy to see this ending as inevitable, the threats she faced as simply setbacks on her path towards immortality. But the crucial point, it seems to me, is that just as Joan of Arc didn't know she was going to die, Elizabeth didn't know she wouldn't die. She didn't know that she would end up like this. There was nothing inevitable about her triumph, nor even about her survival. So what I want to do today is start with one very, very particular telling of her story that might make us stop and think about some of the formative experiences in her life. And the version I want to start with is this. It might be familiar to some of you. It's a Ladybird book, the story of the first Queen Elizabeth, published exactly 60 years ago in 1958. And what the author, the wonderfully named L. Dugard Peach, has to say about Elizabeth's early life is this. Now, you may not be able to read it from where you are, but I'll read it to you, a bit of story time. On a fine Sunday in the late summer of the year 1533, more than 400 years ago, a baby girl was born in a palace at Greenwich on the River Thames between London and the sea. Her parents were the King and Queen of England, Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn, the daughter of an alderman of the City of London. The child was christened Elizabeth. Her father and mother, who were disappointed because she was not a boy, did not know that she was to rule over England as one of the greatest queens ever to sit on the English throne. King Henry VIII had been married before, and Elizabeth had an elder sister named Mary. Mary was 16 years older than Elizabeth and was a very different kind of person. She was to cause Elizabeth much trouble and unhappiness when they both grew up. And with that, we and our fellow Ladybird readers are whisked on to the reign of Elizabeth's sister Mary, who came to the throne when Elizabeth herself was not quite 20. So by this account, all of Elizabeth's problems seem to be traceable to Mary, a very different kind of person, by which we might intuit that she was Catholic rather than safely C of E. And of Elizabeth's apparently happily married parents, Henry VIII and, by this account, the not only C of E, but laudably middle class Anne Boleyn, we hear no more. But what an extraordinary amount glides by under the surface of this single, nothing to see here, page, in which Elizabeth's glorious destiny is already being loudly signalled. First, most strikingly, is the fact that this happy family tableau lasted little more than 2 years. When Elizabeth was not yet three, her mother, Anne Boleyn, was killed on the orders of her father. Now, this is perhaps the most familiar bit of the bludgeoningly familiar story of Henry VIII and his six wives. Divorced, beheaded, died. Divorced, beheaded, survived. But here's the first point where I think we need to stop ourselves. Because in 1536, beheading was not simply a known risk you ran if you tried to fly high at the Tudor court. Anne didn't know she'd been putting her life on the line when she married Henry. Before 1536, high-born women simply didn't face execution, no matter what they'd done. I've looked all the way back to the Conquest, and as far as I've been able, the centuries before that, and I cannot find, in all those years, a single English noblewoman, let alone an anointed queen, as Anne was, who'd been sentenced to death. This was an unprecedented and deeply shocking moment. And it left Anne's only child facing a terrifyingly unpredictable future. For 2.5 years, Elizabeth had been Princess of England, the heir to her father's throne. Now, with her mother found guilty on trumped-up charges of adultery with 5 men, one of them her own brother, Elizabeth was a bastard, no longer a princess, but simply the Lady Elizabeth. And she was so young that she was left without any real memory, not only of her mother, but also of a time when her own position in the world had been truly safe. And that's before we get to the fact that over the next 6 years, Elizabeth gained and lost 3 stepmothers. Jane Seymour died in 1537, giving birth to Henry's only son. Anne of Cleves was then rejected by Henry in 1540, before their marriage had even taken effect. And then Catherine Howard, a teenage cousin of Elizabeth's mother, was killed in 1542 in the same way as Anne, as a result of similar charges of sexual misconduct. All before Elizabeth was 9. Then, from the time she was almost 10, a 4th stepmother, Catherine Parr, provided some measure of greater stability within the royal family. But of the 3 royal children, Elizabeth was by far the most vulnerable. Edward was the cosseted heir to the throne. Mary, the daughter of a Spanish princess, at least had powerful relatives on the continent to keep an eye on her welfare. But for Elizabeth, there was only her father, the man who had killed her mother. He was the one certainty that remained. Without his approval, she couldn't hope to flourish. As she said in the only surviving letter she wrote to Henry at 12, probably just before this portrait was painted, "I am bound unto you as Lord by the law of royal authority, as Lord and Father by the law of nature, and as greatest Lord and matchless and most benevolent Father by the divine law, and by all laws and duties I am bound unto your majesty in various and manifold ways." Now, this was a schoolroom exercise designed to demonstrate to her father her mastery of rhetoric, but it doesn't mean it wasn't also fundamentally true. So what did all of this trauma and uncertainty, what did it do to Elizabeth? Seemingly, the most straightforward answer is that we don't know. There is no record, for example, in the surviving sources of Elizabeth ever directly mentioning her mother, not even speaking her name. And arguments from silence aren't easy for historians to make. I wanted to give you a sense of a couple of responses to this dilemma, more or less taken at random from all the various biographies of Elizabeth that have been written. Professor David Lodes, for example, suggests that how much Elizabeth would have remembered of her mother is highly uncertain. She was less than 3 years old at the time of Anne's execution. Although she must have seen her fairly frequently, they had never spent long in each other's company. In later life, she was very aware of her mother's fate, but seems not to have been emotionally affected by it. By the time that she was old enough to think about such things, she knew that it was her father who mattered, who was still there. And he goes on to suggest that, in fact, in practical terms, it was probably Elizabeth's governess who suffered the most. David Starkey says this: Anne Boleyn's death was a terrible blow for Elizabeth, and her father's role in it more terrible still. But how deep the wound went, we do not know, as Elizabeth never wrote or spoke a single word about it. Her father's name was to be constantly on her lips, her mother's and her mother's death, never. The one immediate impact Starkey points to is that the shower of lovely clothes which Anne Boleyn had lavished on her daughter suddenly dried up. And of course, that is the one thing that can be directly traced in the financial records. But after that, he sees Elizabeth as a young woman who inherited all the overweening self-confidence and egotism of her house. But there are other ways of reading silence, ways that might suggest not overweening self-confidence, but the insecurity that comes from traumatic emotional dissonance. We know she never spoke of Anne. We know she lionized the father who had killed her. But when Elizabeth eventually had complete control over her own environment, she chose to surround herself with her mother's relatives in her Privy Council and in the royal household. And there's one exquisite object that survives that seems more intimate still: a mother-of-pearl locket ring, which Elizabeth owned in her later years. On the outside, when it's closed, it has Elizabeth's monogram, ER, Elizabeth Regina, in table-cut diamonds. But on the inside, these miniature paired portraits of Elizabeth and Anne. So at the very least, it doesn't seem to me that we can argue that the knowledge of her mother's violent death was completely absent from her psyche. In other words, her silence can be seen as evidence in itself. Because Elizabeth's opacity, her unreadability, isn't a trick of the historical light. She was just as unfathomable to her contemporaries, the people around her, as she is to posterity. And her habit of wearing a public mask, of presenting a carefully constructed public self, was one that began very early. In February 1548, probably not long after this portrait was painted, she wrote in a letter to her brother, now the young King Edward VI, that it is, as your majesty is not unaware, rather characteristic of my nature not to say in words as much as I think in my mind. There are two things we could note here. First, that wonderful self-description of her guardedness, the sense that there's so much more going on behind those dark eyes that she'd inherited from her mother. And second, there's the self-referentiality. She's saying this out loud. She's saying out loud that she doesn't say as much as she's thinking. And bear this in mind as we go on. So often, Elizabeth's guardedness takes the form of hiding in plain sight. She will sometimes tell us, and the people around her, what she's thinking. We just won't always know whether or not to believe her. When she wrote that letter to her brother, a year after her father's death, she was living with the widowed queen, her stepmother, Catherine Parr, and Catherine's new husband, Thomas Seymour, the brother of the dead queen, Jane. The Tudor family was just made for soap opera. A different kind of Coronation Street, perhaps. But the uncertainties of Elizabeth's position had only multiplied. The lives of most royal women were shaped by diplomatic marriages to royal or noble husbands. This was a matrimonial game in which Elizabeth and her half-sister Mary were pawns. But they were pawns whose value was extraordinarily difficult to assess. They'd each been declared illegitimate in turn when their father's marriage to their mothers had been annulled. Legally, they were bastards. At the same time, Henry's Succession Act of 1544 named them as royal heirs to their brother Edward. Legally, they might inherit the throne. Henry himself wasn't bothered by this contradiction. Like the White Queen through the looking glass, he had no difficulty believing six impossible things before breakfast, if it helped with his project of making sure that what he wanted was always somehow right. But it left both Elizabeth and Mary in political limbo. Who among the royal families of Europe would want a royal bastard as a bride? And who, given that these two young women might just one day wear the crown, would the English king and his council let them marry? For now, Elizabeth found a place within her new makeshift family until in May 1548, she was suddenly sent away from her stepmother's home. At the end of that summer, Catherine died in childbirth. And 4 months after that, in January 1549, Thomas Seymour was arrested on charges of treason. And at that point, it emerged that Seymour had not only flirted outrageously with Elizabeth when they were all under the same roof, but after Catherine's death, he had planned and hoped to marry her. And Elizabeth, it turned out, hadn't been resistant to Seymour's advances. I think I might have a picture of him. Here he is. If, as seems likely, this was an adolescent crush on a much older, handsome, charismatic man, a father figure who wasn't completely sexually out of bounds if he did ask for her hand, it was only likely to have been intensified by the fact that the prospect of marrying Seymour would spare Elizabeth the usual fate of royal daughters. And again, I think we're so used to the idea that a good marriage for a princess was a royal one, that we don't think enough about the reality of sending a teenage girl alone to a foreign country to become the wife of a man she'd never met. But if marrying Seymour had been Elizabeth's daydream, his arrest suddenly revealed it as nightmarishly dangerous. And for the first time, Elizabeth's public mask became not just habit, but essential protection. Under interrogation, with her closest servants in prison, Elizabeth wouldn't budge. She had not been involved in Seymour's plans, she said, and there had been no discussion of marriage without the explicit proviso that the King's Council must agree. Sir Robert Tyrwhitt, the gentleman who'd been put in charge of extracting her confession, had been confident to start with. "I do see it in her face that she's guilty," he said. But only one day later, he was sounding a lot more harassed. "I do assure your grace," he told Seymour's brother Edward, who was in charge of government, "she has a very good wit, and nothing is gotten off her but by great policy." Actually, he could have stopped at "nothing is gotten off her." Thomas Seymour lost his head as a traitor in March 1549, but Elizabeth, at 15, had saved herself and her servants by taking up a defensible position and refusing to move. It wouldn't be the last time. The same tactic served her well during the attempted coup after her brother Edward's early death in 1553, when her Protestant cousin Jane Grey was placed on the throne in the attempt to exclude her Catholic half-sister Mary from the succession. Elizabeth kept her head down so successfully during this crisis that we know nothing about anything she did or said within the walls of her home at Hatfield during the 9 days it took to secure Mary's victory. And then, to catch up with our ladybird selves, she faced the very real dangers that confronted her with Mary on the throne, though not because Mary was, as Eldugard Peach would have it, a very strange woman. I do love this portrait of Mary, not least because she's wearing at her breast a very magnificent pearl that she was given by her future husband, Philip II of Spain. It was a pearl that had recently been found, called La Peregrina, and some years later, it was given by Richard Burton to Elizabeth Taylor, reset into a Cartier diamond necklace. And there are some rather different pictures. I must look one out, but there are some rather different pictures of Elizabeth Taylor wearing that same pearl nestled into her cleavage. I'm not sure Mary would have approved where it ended up. But from the moment of Mary's accession, Elizabeth was once again heir to the throne for the first time since her mother's death. But the complications and the contradictions of the almighty mess that Henry VIII had made had caught up with her and Mary both. Mary was Catholic. Her whole identity was predicated on the faith that her father had abandoned when he'd rejected her mother. And Elizabeth necessarily was Protestant, the living embodiment of the new Church of England that Henry had created in order to marry her mother. So unless or until Mary had a child, Mary's Catholic England was at risk with Elizabeth as the Protestant heir to the throne. And of course, the risk went both ways round. Within months, Elizabeth found herself in the Tower, a prisoner, suspected of treason, in the same apartments where her mother had spent her last days. This was intense psychological pressure, but her composure was impenetrable, just as it had been during the Seymour affair. She was innocent of conspiracy, she declared. If Mary and her council believed otherwise, they must prove it. She cried, she did show emotion, but she never changed that message. And the truth was, as the Spanish ambassador was forced to concede through gritted teeth, there is not sufficient evidence to condemn Elizabeth. Elizabeth survived. Not only that, but she was saved by Mary's tragedy. Mary failed in her attempt to bear a child. She failed even to live into her 50s, as both of her parents had done. In November 1558, Mary died at the age of just 42. Now, against all the odds, Elizabeth was queen. She was 25 years old, 25 years of which 23 and a half had been spent in varying degrees of uncertainty and outright danger. But the threats were not over. They'd just changed in form. Now, clearly, unless I was going to keep you here for the rest of the evening, which I promise I won't, I can't talk about everything that happened in Elizabeth's reign. 45 minutes is even more impossible than 25,000 words. But what I can do is point out some of the ways in which I think her experiences and her psychology shaped her approach to the challenges she faced as queen. First of all, it's worth saying that over the course of 25 watchful years, she'd become an extremely astute judge of character. If she could help it, she was not going to make the same mistake she'd made with Thomas Seymour ever again. She appointed a government full of loyal, able men, from her spirit, as she called him, William Cecil, to Cecil's protégé, Walsingham, Francis Walsingham, of whom she was less fond, but she knew just how useful he was, and her master of the horse, Robert Dudley, of whom she was a great deal more fond in ways that raised eyebrows across Europe. But these loyal, able men and others with them formed the heart of her regime. And though their relationship with her could at times be very difficult, her commitment to them and theirs to her never wavered. Poor Cecil, at 77, crippled by arthritis and gout, was still working as hard as ever, right up to the bitter end. Elizabeth, in other words, was setting up a court, a government, of people she trusted and was right to trust. And then she tried, wherever she could, to avoid change. And that was her instinct, her choice in policy too. Two major, profoundly difficult issues faced her at the very start of her reign. First, religion. It was clear she wasn't, she couldn't be, any kind of Catholic. What wasn't clear was what kind of Protestant she might turn out to be in a country and a continent riven by religious division. The settlement that was hammered out at the beginning of 1559 in Elizabeth's very first parliament shows all the signs, I would argue, of being Elizabeth's own. It was a theologically idiosyncratic one that few, if any, of her leading churchmen actually supported in its detail. It was too much for Mary's Catholic bishops in its definitive re-breaking with Rome. And it wasn't enough for the committed Protestants who supported Elizabeth, who wanted much more far-reaching reforms aligned with those that were taking place on the continent. But Elizabeth wanted a church that emphasized obedience, loyalty, conformity, rather than ideological hard lines, so that as many as possible of her subjects could offer her their obedience in worship, as well as everything else. It was, fittingly, a church in her own image. It was performative and theatrical, with vestments and ritual that Elizabeth loved and her bishops hated. And the doctrine of the Eucharist was adjusted in the Elizabethan church to allow room for interpretation of the central doctrine of whether the bread and wine actually really represented the body and blood of Christ. It was an issue over which theologians and ideologues fought, and Elizabeth proved willing to fudge. As her first Archbishop of Canterbury, she appointed Matthew Parker, one of the few leading clerics who had not spent Mary's reign in Calvinist Geneva. And we might also note that Matthew Parker had once, earlier in his career, been her mother's chaplain. And for the first time ever, she appointed not one single churchman to her Privy Council. So this was a deliberate act. Pressure for change was built into the Elizabethan settlement, given that she had no choice but to appoint bishops who wanted more reform than she did. But she took up her own position and she sought to defend it. You'll be detecting a theme by now, I think, and it appears again even in the apparently giddier and endlessly debated question of her marriage, which of course opened up the can of worms that was the whole question of her sex. And here we need to recognise that she and Mary before her were wrestling with a fundamental challenge to the whole nature of their sovereignty, because the accession to the throne of these Tudor queens left contemporaries facing some perplexing questions. Could a woman rule at all? And if so, could a woman rule alone? After all, as St. Paul had told us, man is the head of woman. And if some form of female rule had to be accepted simply because there were no male heirs left on the Tudor family tree, then at least some male help would surely be required so that the Queen could be supported in the labour of governing and assisted in matters that are not of ladies' capacity, as the Emperor Charles V had told Mary when she came to the throne. Plus, it was an alarming fact that Elizabeth was the last of her line. The universal assumption was that she needed an heir, and the sooner the better, to secure the future of the kingdom. But Elizabeth turned out to have other ideas. She didn't think she needed help to rule, other than the advice, not the instructions, the advice of the counsellors she'd appointed. As she said in a prayer she wrote soon after her accession, God had chosen me, thy handmaid, to be over thy people, that I may preserve them in thy peace. Under thy sovereignty, princes reign, and all the people obey. And given that fact, given that she meant to rule, what would it mean for her to marry? If man was the head of woman, then would her husband be sovereign over the sovereign? Any hint of that would mean that Elizabeth marrying an Englishman would be a logical impossibility. How could she owe wifely obedience to one of her own subjects? But it also meant that marrying a foreign prince would run the risk of the kingdom being subsumed by a foreign power. And that fear, rather than any immediate reality, had already caused her sister Mary significant problems after her marriage to Philip of Spain. So the question of marriage presented Elizabeth with problems no king would face. And so did the prospect of having an heir. Two of Elizabeth's stepmothers had died in childbirth. There was a very real risk that even if a suitable husband could somehow be found, and if Elizabeth were to become pregnant, England might be left with neither heir nor queen. And again, no king ever faced that danger. A king could safely keep marrying, as Elizabeth's father had done, until the required heir appeared. And to these very real political objections, we might then add a personal one. The association between sex, marriage, and violent death in her past was hardly likely to encourage her in that direction. In fact, if we look at Elizabeth's first speech to her first parliament, that's exactly what we see. An insistence that she, not her subjects, would choose any husband she did ever decide to marry. And that even if she didn't, God would provide an heir for the country by some other means. But for herself, she said, and bear in mind, this is 1559, this is right at the start of her reign, she said, in the end, this shall be for me sufficient, that a marble stone shall declare that a queen, having reigned such a time, lived and died a virgin. She said it. She said it out loud at the very beginning of her reign. But as it turned out, and as so often with Elizabeth, no one was listening. This time, it wasn't just her public mask that let her hide in plain sight. She was also simply not believed. For that she should wish to remain a maid and never marry is inconceivable, as one German diplomat wrote. And so began the courtships, the dalliances, and the negotiations, the 2 decades of a matrimonial dance about which there have been centuries of speculation. This is an image from those years, an image we don't usually see, a portrait of Elizabeth as a potential bride, surrounded by symbols of fertility. She did take part in this matrimonial dance. She went through the motions, but in such a way that her contemporaries were baffled. As the Spanish ambassador wrote in 1566, she is so nimble in her dealing and threads in and out of this business in such a way that her most intimate favourites fail to understand her, and her intentions are therefore variously interpreted. And of course, given how mercurial and simultaneously opaque she managed to be, I can't guarantee what was in her mind. But I can point out just how many times she said she didn't want to marry and intended not to. And I can see the profound advantages from Elizabeth's own point of view of that position. She could create space for herself, politically and diplomatically, by standing still. Every suit for her hand was a valuable card to be played in the poker game of international diplomacy. But saying no, sooner or often later, meant she still kept her freedom of action for the future, rather than being locked into an alliance that couldn't subsequently be changed. And her sex was in play again here too. When her father married Catherine of Aragon, the Spanish princess, it didn't mean that he was locked into an alliance with Spain forevermore. But when Mary married Philip of Spain, when the Queen of England married the King of Spain, that was an alliance that it was going to be much, much harder to break. Elizabeth drove her ministers mad because, woman as she was and men as they were, they thought they knew better. And there's no doubt that she could be. She was infuriatingly capricious. But what we also need to recognise, I think, is that a never-ending process of apparently changing her mind from moment to moment could also be the outward expression of a fundamental intention not to change her mind, not to take a step that she saw as more dangerous than the situation in which she already found herself. It seems to me that on every front, what Elizabeth was trying to do was preserve the known risks of the position she'd taken up, the status quo she'd established, rather than precipitating unknown dangers through the unpredictable effects of change. And that was never more clear than in her management of the greatest and most long-running threat to her reign, the fact that the Catholic world saw her not only as a heretic, but thanks to the circumstances of her birth, as a bastard who had no right to the throne. This was an implicit threat from the very beginning, but it intensified and became terrifyingly explicit in the 1570s and 1580s, once her Catholic cousin, Mary Queen of Scots, who had been claiming the throne of England for years already, calling herself Queen of Scotland and of England. Once Mary had lost her own throne and fled Scotland to become a prisoner in Elizabeth's England at the end of the 1560s. Now again, there's so much to say about this extraordinary situation and this extraordinary relationship between two cousins who seem in some ways a reversed mirror image of one another. Mary's Catholic, Elizabeth's Protestant. Mary had been Queen of Scotland since she was 6 days old. She'd had a life of entitlement, of expectation, of just assuming that authority was hers, and Elizabeth's life had been in every way different. But just briefly, as a vicious spiral took hold in which English Catholics were increasingly forced to choose between their loyalty to their God and their Queen, Elizabeth did try to hold the line. She didn't want to kill Mary. For all that Mary was the focus of the plots against her, and increasingly, as time went on, a plotter in chief. She didn't want to because she didn't want to kill an anointed queen. The beheading of an anointed queen was, after all, a devastatingly unhappy part of her past. And it was also dangerous. She herself was an anointed queen. It was a dangerous precedent she didn't want to set for her own future. And not only that, but Mary, under lock and key, with all her correspondence intercepted by the ever-vigilant Francis Walsingham, Elizabeth's spymaster, was at least a known danger. If she was gone, the threat, as Elizabeth of all people knew, wouldn't disappear. What form would it take next? And here's where we might note that when Elizabeth was finally pressed into signing Mary's death warrant in 1587, after a plot that was not just uncovered, but probably pushed along its way by Walsingham in his desperation to remove what he saw as the intense danger of the Scots Queen. At that point, the Catholic claim to Elizabeth's throne passed instead to King Philip of Spain, who was a descendant of the 14th century Prince John of Gaunt, and therefore of Edward III. And the immediate result? The Armada. 10 years earlier, Walsingham had referred to Elizabeth obliquely and despairingly as us who are in a deep sleep and heedlessly secure. He couldn't get her to do what he thought was necessary, killing Mary for the security of herself and the realm. He couldn't understand that his queen, who'd suffered from insomnia all her life, had a different understanding of where the route to personal and political security might lie. For Elizabeth, such security as she'd ever been able to find lay, as one of her mottos had it, in being semper eadem, always the same. But of course, nothing could ever really be always the same. Elizabeth had learned that in the process of attempting and failing to resist the political tide that had swept away Mary, Queen of Scots, and brought the Armada to England's shores. But it didn't stop her trying. Once time had taken away from even the most hopeful of her counsellors the possibility that she might one day marry and have children, she turned herself instead from a virgin queen into the virgin queen, Gloriana, an icon decked about with signs and symbols, the eternal incarnation of her kingdom's God-given greatness. But here too, the cracks started to show. Not just in the glazed makeup she used to create this mask of youth. This is a portrait painted when Elizabeth was in her 60s. I'm always very envious of the Photoshop that Elizabeth was able to deploy in her creation of her self-image. But it wasn't only the increasing gap between the portraits of Elizabeth and the actual reality. Cracks also started to show in the loss of her right-hand men. First Dudley in 1588, then Walsingham in 1590, and then Cecil in 1598. William Cecil's son Robert stepped ably into his father's place, but it was in these years, as age caught up with the Queen and her counsellors, that she made her first major misstep in her judgment of character, in promoting Dudley's vapidly narcissistic stepson, Essex, in a vain attempt to fill his dead stepfather's shoes. But there is one more way in which it could be said that Elizabeth's considered deployment of insecurity helped tackle the last threat to herself and her kingdom. The succession to her throne had been a subject of tense debate throughout her reign, and Elizabeth herself had consistently refused to decide or even discuss it, despite her minister's insistence that her kingdom's security depended on it. And again, she had told her people why. She, who, as she said, had been the second person in her sister's reign, knew all too well that if she did acknowledge an heir, that person would provide a focus for those who wanted to plot against her and at the same time alienate those among her loyal subjects who disagreed with her choice. But because she wouldn't name a successor, a different kind of plot took place. Her own ministers started working in secret to ensure the smooth succession of the one man who seemed to offer England some kind of stability. James VI of Scotland, the Protestant son of Mary, Queen of Scots, whom Elizabeth had kept dangling on a string for years with the prospect that he might, possibly perhaps one day inherit her crown. And when Elizabeth died, in the darkness of the early morning on the 24th of March, 1603, just a few months short of her 70th birthday, one Londoner noted in his diary that there was no tumult, no contradiction, no disorder in the city. Every man went about his business as readily, as peaceably, as securely, as though there had been no change, nor any news ever heard of competitors. And that seems to me to be Elizabeth's final triumph. Thank you very much for listening.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.